This is the third day of this January 2009 Rohatsu Sesshin. And we'll resume reading from the letters of the Chinese Zen master Yuan Wu from a book called Zen Letters, translated by Thomas and J.C. Cleary. This one begins, "By even speaking a phrase to you, I have already doused you with dirty water. It would be even worse for me to put a twinkle in my eye and raise my eyebrow to you, or rap on the meditation seat, or hold up a whisk, or demand, 'What is this?' As for shouting and hitting, it's obvious that this is just a pile of bones on level ground." So he starts by making this fundamental point in Zen that there's nothing to teach. There's nothing I can give you. There's nothing you need from me. And that all devices, words and devices, are beside the point. So what is the point? Zen is beyond words. It's even beyond actions and devices. But it is not apart from them. So Lin Qi was Yuan Wu's most famous predecessor in the Chinese Zen. His lineage, Lin Qi himself said, "To speak of a thing misses the mark." He goes on, "There are also the type who don't know good from bad and ask questions about Buddha and Dharma and Zen and the Tao. They ask to be helped. They beg to be received. They seek knowledge and sayings and theories relating to the Buddhist teaching and to transcending the world and to accommodating the world. This is washing dirt in mud and washing mud in dirt. When will they ever manage to clear it away?" Roshi Kaplow used to say, "Most questions are insincere." Very commonly, questions are just a way to avoid oneself, avoid facing oneself. If you can come up with enough questions, then you can avoid the thing itself. I've learned in giving introductory workshops and public talks that people who ask the most questions are usually the ones who don't really get serious about practice. It's all so plain and self-evident, this Dharma. Why complicate it with unnecessary questions? Now, practical questions, that's different. Even there, people can just drum up practical questions that they know that they could resolve themselves just through their practice. But at least with practical questions, these are things that can save the practitioner some time. May not be the best thing in the long term to save time. In ancient times, I've read a new monk would be told, given only the most general instructions. They might be told to the story where a monk asked Zhao Zhou, does even a dog have Buddha nature? Zhao Zhou said, moo. And then that's it. They said, okay, how do you understand that? Without any specific practical instructions on how to work on that as a koan. And you know what? They would find their way into it on their own. And it's the more time we devote to this matter, the more the results will show that time. The more they will reflect the depth of work on it. He goes on, some people hear this kind of talk and jump to conclusions, claiming, I understand. Fundamentally, there is nothing to Buddhism. It's there in everybody. As I spend my days eating food and wearing clothes, has there ever been anything lacking? Then they settle down in the realm of unconcerned ordinariness, far from realizing that nothing like this has ever been part of the real practice of Buddhism. This is not unknown today among people who dip their toes in Zen, where they suddenly are seized with what they think is some profound insight, and they say, all right, there's nothing to this, there's nothing to do, there's nowhere to go, it's just eating and sleeping, watching TV, anything is it. And then they just wash their hands of it. This is similar. This is a form of what the Japanese call Buji Zen, the notion that because we are all inherently enlightened from the very beginning, no beginning time, that there is nothing to do. It's a fatal mistake to make. To fall into this pit, because if you convince yourself that there's nothing to do, then all hope for realization and for development, spiritual development, is forfeited. Dogen, perhaps addressing this very danger, he said, "The Dharma is abundantly inherent in each individual. Yet without practice, it will not be manifested, and without enlightenment, it will not be perceived." Well, this is preaching to the choir. He goes on, "So we know that you must be someone genuinely within the tradition before you can be fully familiar with the fundamental portion of the vehicle of the school that has come down from time immemorial. If you really have an entry into enlightenment, then you know when to start and when to stop, when to advance and when to withdraw, and you can distinguish what is permissible from what is not." Distinguish what is permissible from what is not would point to this huge, huge vital aspect of practice, which is that of morality. "Leaving behind all leakages, day by day you get closer to the truth and more familiar with it." Leakages is an old Chinese term, at least as it's translated for us, that would mean a kind of relaxing in one's effort, becoming lax, letting the mind wander. In this way, this samadhi power that steadily accumulates through practice then diminishes somewhat. "As you go further, you change like a panther who no longer sticks to its den. You leap out of the corral. Then you no longer doubt all the sayings of the world's enlightened teachers. You are like cast iron. This is precisely the time to apply effort and cultivate practice and nourish your realization." Notice he doesn't say, okay, now that you've no longer doubt any of the teachings and you're like cast iron, now you can rest. Nope. "This is precisely the time to apply effort and cultivate practice and nourish your realization." The thing to know is when you get to this stage, then applying effort and cultivating practice and nourishing one's realization is the most natural and the most wonderful thing. I think people new to practice, they think in terms of just getting this god-awful practice behind me so that I can then take it easy. But it doesn't work that way. And as you really really allow this practice to fill your whole being, then it's something that you don't want to stop. It's a great, great feeling to reach this point of no backsliding, where you just, who would not want to do this? Who would not want to polish the mind and feel energized and deeply calm and purified, bright and open and responsive? I mean, ever more of all these qualities. No matter how far one goes into these, we can always become more of that. And when you've been doing it long enough, you work out all the posture issues and resistances to just simply taking the time to stop one's frenetic activity throughout the day, to stop oneself, sit down, then it becomes the most restorative, most luscious kind of thing to do. After that, you can kindle the inexhaustible lamp and travel the unobstructed path. You relinquish your body and your life to liberate living beings. You enable them to come out of their cages and eliminate their attachments and bonds. You cure them of the diseases of being attached to being enlightened, so that having emerged from the deep pit of liberation, they can become uncontrived, unencumbered, joyfully alive people of the path. He's referring here to a very, very advanced state of freedom, where there is no thought of enlightenment or delusion left in the mind, no notions that impinge on one's direct experience of things. No, certainly no notion of having attained anything, which itself is a kind of delusion. As we said yesterday, there is nothing to attain. It's a matter of losing what binds us. It's all losing. Emptying, purging, cleansing. When you yourself have crossed over, you must not abandon the carrying out of your bodhisattva vows. You must be mindful of liberating all beings and steadfastly endure the attendant hardship and toil in order to serve as a boat on the ocean of all knowledge. Only then will you have some accord with the path. Well, again, the mandate of Mahayana Buddhism, which is we do this in order to pass it on to others, to help others, to free others. How can anyone with true awareness stop as long as there are other people who are suffering? This would be a complete betrayal of one's realization. To feel satisfied because one's own work is done on oneself. Such a pitiful perspective. It's sort of the survivalist mentality, stockpiling food and supplies, fuel, and everything, so to take care of oneself and one's family or friends or whatever. Very short-sighted, limited way to understand things. Looking out for number one. He goes on, don't be a brittle pillar or a feeble lamp. I guess he's just saying, don't stop short of full realization. Don't bat around your little clean ball of inner mystical experience. It's one of the most memorable statements in the whole book. It's another thing to This is a warning not only for someone who's gone very far, but even people newer to the path is to be aware of the tendency to get off on some little experience during Zazen and make a whole lot of it. He says, you may have understood for yourself, but what good does it do? You could say, what good does it do for others? The next letter begins, brave, spirited wearers of the patched robe possess an outstanding, extraordinary aspect. With great determination, they give up conventional society. They look upon worldly status and evanescent fame as dust in the wind, as clouds floating by, as echoes in a valley. You can see from the way that Yuan Wu writes why the Blue Cliff Record, the book he edited, would command so much respect and admiration in Chinese literature. Since they already have great faculties and great capacity from the past, they know that this level exists, and they transcend birth and death and move beyond holy and ordinary. This is the indestructible true essence that all the enlightened ones of all times witness, the wondrous mind that alone the generations of enlightened teachers have communicated. He's paying great tribute to those with the faith, and it does take great faith, with the faith to give up worldly life in order to devote oneself to this lifelong practice of purifying the self for the sake of all beings. This phrase, since they already have great faculties and great capacity from the past, he's referring to past lives. In Buddhism, historically, to be born and into a life where you become a monk is considered the best of karma, and to have that kind of karma, and to be a monk, to end up in the robes of a monk, reflects great faculties and great capacity from the past. He's talking here about the monastic ideal. The reality, we know from some studying, we know that in ancient China, many of the monks did not arrive there with such lofty ideals. Instead, they would sometimes get ordained to escape paying taxes, or they would just be given over to the monastery by their parents who couldn't afford to keep them. To tread this unique path, to be a fragrant elephant or a giant golden-winged bird, it is necessary to charge past the millions of categories and types and fly above them, to cut off the flow and brush against the heavens. How could the enlightened willingly be petty creatures, confined within distinctions of high and low, and victory and defeat, trying futilely to make comparative judgments of instantaneous experience and being utterly turned around by gain and loss. He says to charge past the millions of categories and types and fly above them. It's to completely renounce all of the many ways that we direct ourselves toward gain, acquisition, building up. But the life of a monk is really the outward manifestation of what we can all realize in our practice, in our zazen. True zazen is the ultimate renunciation. Becoming a monk is easy compared to the absolute giving up of thoughts, of involvement in our thoughts, which really means involvement with ourself, self-concern. That's most of what our thoughts consist of, self-interest. I, me, my. So we have this practice, these several practices we have inherited from these great monks that enable us to renounce thoughts, all the trafficking of mind, thought forms of every kind. We have the tools. We have to use them. For this reason, he goes on, in olden times, the people of great enlightenment did not pay attention to trivial matters and did not aspire to the shallow and easily accessible. They aroused their determination to transcend the Buddhas and patriarchs. They wanted to bear the heavy responsibility that no one can fully take up, to liberate all living beings, to remove suffering and bring peace, to smash the ignorance and blindness that obstructs the way. They wanted to break the poisonous arrows of ignorant folly and extract the thorns of arbitrary views from the eye of reality. They wanted to make the scenery of the fundamental ground clear and reveal the original face before the empty eon. For all of Zen's quarrel with words, we can appreciate that words, live words like this, words of color and feeling, do have the ability to turn the mind toward that is which is most noble, most exalted in our potentiality. You should train your mind and value actual practice wholeheartedly, exerting all your power, not shrinking from the cold or the heat. Go to the spot where you meditate and kill your mental monkey and slay your intellectual horse. Make yourself like a dead tree, like a withered stump. These images, a dead tree and a withered stump, we come across them in other various texts in Chinese Zen. They convey the kind of utter silence of a mind that has been, that has reached, well, stillness. A dead tree, a withered stump. No mental activity. Wide open, bright. Let me just revise that. It more commonly refers to the state right before awakening, kind of a point of maximum density where the doubt mass has congealed to the point where one feels almost dead. The world, as we imagine it, the world stops in a way. Everything stops. And then out of that state of quiescence, then the mind turns around. Suddenly you penetrate through. How could it be attained from anyone else? You discover the hidden treasure. You light the lamp in the dark room. You launch the boat across the center of the ford. You experience great liberation, and without producing a single thought, you immediately attain true awakening. Having passed through the gate into the inner truth, you ascend to the site of universal light. Then you sit in the impeccably pure, supreme seat of the emptiness of all things. He's talking about deep, deep enlightenment, not just getting through one's koan. This phrase, you ascend to the site of universal light. It's unusual. In Zen, the masters don't so often use images of light, other than the word enlightenment, but that can be understood in an entirely different way. I appreciate the word enlightenment more as a becoming lighter, becoming in terms of weight, getting a weight off you, becoming unburdened. This is becoming enlightened. But Zen more often refers to the darkness of a mind that is empty. Zen master once said, "The great round mirror of wisdom is black as pitch." Light is more often associated with knowledge, learning, ideas. Skipping now to another letter where he says, "My teacher Wu Zhu often said, 'I have been here for 5 decades and I have seen thousands and thousands of Zen followers come up to the corner of my meditation seat. They were all just seeking to become Buddhas and to expound Buddhism. I have never seen a single genuine wearer of the patched robe.'" It's pretty hot. Pretty stiff, high standards. And then Yuan Wu echoes that. He says, "How true this is. As we observe the present time, even those who expound Buddhism are hard to find, much less any genuine people. The age is in decline, and the sages are further and further distant. In the whole great land of China, the lineage of Buddha is dying out right before our very eyes. We may find one person or half a person who is putting the Dharma into practice, but we would not dare to expect them to be like the great exemplars of enlightenment, the dragons and elephants of yore. And yet, we know that at this time that not just scholars, but teachers can look back and say and see that at this time, Yuan Wu's time, there were great teachers, and not to mention others who followed him, Da Wei, Hakuin, Dogen. It seems to be kind of a custom or convention of some of these illustrious masters to lament that we've reached the Dharma ending age. To a practitioner, it's beside the point. Each one of us has our own work to do. We have this great matter to resolve for ourselves, to find our own freedom and then to be able to help others find theirs. It does really no good to stop and try to evaluate former times as they compare to the present time. And then he says, nevertheless, if you simply know the procedures and aims of practical application of the Dharma and carry on correctly from beginning to end, you are already producing a lotus from within the fire. So we can all breathe a sigh of relief. All is not lost. If you know how to practice, there you are. The important thing is having discovered this path and to be able to work on oneself with these ancient methods that have been tested and refined over the centuries. How fortunate we are. You must put aside all the conditioning that entangles you. Then you will be able to perceive the inner content of the great enlightenment that has come down since ancient times. Be at rest wherever you are and carry on the secret, closely continuous, intimate level practice. The devas will have no road to strew flowers on, and demons and outsiders will not be able to find your tracks. This is what it means to truly leave home and thoroughly understand oneself. Well, this phrase about the devas and the demons and outsiders, it's really just, we could just say it means to transcend conditions, to transcend change itself. Find that which is beyond change, within change. If, after you have reached this level, circumstances arise as the result of merit that led you to come forth and extend a hand to communicate enlightenment to others, this would not be inappropriate. As Buddha said, just acquiesce in the truth. You surely won't be deceived. And then he ends, but even for me to speak this way is another case of a man from bandit land seeing off a thief. This is so much in the spirit of Zen. After a talk or something, to then to sweep it away with this kind of a statement. Now, this is balderdash. Just so many words. Get rid of it. The next letter begins, if you want to attain intimacy, and there's a capital I there, the first thing is, don't seek it. If you attain through seeking, you have already fallen into interpretive understanding. This is especially true because this great treasury extends through all times, clearly evident, empty, and bright. Since time without beginning, it has been your own basic root. You depend on its power entirely in all your actions. Okay, another reminder that it's not something we can go out and get, this enlightenment, this great treasury is not a matter of past, present, or future. It is beyond time, has no beginning and no end, this enlightened nature that we all share. It has always been our very ground, our basic root, as he says. All of our actions are expressions of this enlightened nature. Actions that are deluded, nothing is apart from this mind. And then he says, you will only pass through to freedom when you cease and desist to the point that not even a single thought is born. Then you penetrate through without falling into sense and matter, and without dwelling in conceptualizations and mental images. It's what it all comes down to, again and again, not dwelling in thoughts and images. They come into the mind. We have no say in them just arising, bubbling up into the mind, but we certainly have some choice into whether we cling to them, dwell in these things. But time is up. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.